Hey everybody, Margie Mintz is in the house. In the house? Is that a thing?
Hi. Do people say that anymore? This is your house.
Okay,
and I'm in it.
Is my house. So thank you for being here.
Thank you for having me.
So let's tell everybody who you are. You're a comedian.
Yes, I'm a comedian.
But you do a lot of things. So
I
you
do.
Know, I always like to you know, like, hey, you're a comedian, but you also.
Well, we haven't seen each other in 3 years,
that
so a lot has happened.
That is true. I mean, you were partially responsible for the Phil Hartman thing happening, so that was
right.
awesome. Thank you
that
so much.
That was cool. And you probably didn't know this, but, you know, I stayed and watched that one.
Oh,
you might assume that as the general manager of the Zephyr Theater, I do that all the time. I do not. Mm-hmm. I almost never watch the things that come in and rent the space, but that was just really interesting to me, and so I stuck around. And
was it fun?
It was really fun.
It was
great.
Because at that point, I was 11. I'd barely done anything on stage, so I was just so nervous. I'm like, Vicki Lewis will carry it. That'll be fine.
Yeah,
but it ended up working out good.
It was very, like, professional and well-paced. I can't believe that was 3 years ago.
I know.
But,
I know.
Yeah.
We were going to do another Phil Hartman thing because of he just got a star on the Walk of Fame.
Yeah.
But we didn't get to organize that. So, really fun to talk in a podcast about things you didn't get around to doing.
maybe you will.
Maybe I will.
No
we'll
doors
see.
Are closed.
Exactly.
Yeah.
So, you wanted to talk about Two Drink Mike
by
Mike Birbiglia. And I, you know, I was like, do I know that album? And then I realized, yeah, I know most of it, but just not, like, I didn't listen to it a lot.
Well, a lot of it, at least a good portion of it, is on his DVD special.
Mm-hmm. And I think that's probably
what what I should have said was nothing.
Yes, right. Okay.
Which he has that. That's the title. Yeah, one of the jokes on the album is that bit. But which I was actually at the live taping for the What I Should Have Said Was Nothing.
Oh, that's awesome.
And that was before I started doing stand up.
Okay.
Right before, and it was just really. Yeah, it was just really great. But the reason I wanted to talk about that album was because it was the album that I listened to that kind of made me realize that, oh, I could do something kind of like that.
Yeah, yeah, yeah.
Because Mike's a storyteller.
Right, right.
And that's the comedy where I kind of feel comfortable is in that realm.
That's
and
awesome.
So the way, because, you know, he's done so much stuff on This American Life.
Sure,
and
sure.
He's a theater guy too. I mean, he's done one man shows, based on his amazing stories, and so I felt like that fit in with my background.
Mm-hmm.
And so, you know, the challenge is putting the stories into a stand up format, which I've done a lot of storytelling shows. I find them infinitely easier for me than stand up.
Sure.
But it's like listening to Two Drink Mike again before coming on here, because it had been a little while. It's amazing how he really does follow the stand-up rule of lots of punchlines.
Oh, yeah.
Like, fast-paced.
I know.
So it's cool that he can do that as well as go on This American Life and kind of smooth it out and not have, you know, laughs every 5 seconds.
Mm-hmm.
You know, that sort of thing. So
he sounds to me, and I'd forgotten because he has evolved a bit, obviously, even in his delivery, but he sounds like a more coherent Mitch Hedberg. He sounds like Mitch Hedberg got tired of mumbling. He's like, all right, no, I have some things to say. Like, he's just so casual.
Totally.
You know what I mean? But at the same time, he's saying these just, good God, these amazing things. Like, I mean, there's this whole run that's like, I think in anybody's hands would be obnoxious about George Bush. I mean, this is 2006, you know, and he's doing this whole George Bush bit that intentionally doesn't start that way.
Right.
It moves into it so gradually that you don't find it. I mean, I'm as liberal as he is, but it can be very obnoxious if it's in the wrong hands. You know?
Absolutely. Well, and I think it's because he's such a likable, pleasant person
that
he can get away with things.
Mm-hmm.
It's also the point of view that he takes is not polarizing.
Sure,
I guess.
100%.
I mean, it's just like, I mean, there's a couple of rape jokes on this album.
I know.
But he pulls them off because it's not shaming the victim. It's kind of talking about how he's awkward and that sort of thing. And so it's really interesting to see how, like, those topics that most comedians just probably better to stay away from it in general.
Mm-hmm.
You know, you never want to say, like, any topic is totally,
of course,
not okay, but it's really interesting. I really do think it's that kind of every guy likable, but I'm awkward, and I, you know what I mean?
Yeah.
and not really being mean.
Right. Yeah. And I don't know, I'm not sure where it comes from. I know a little bit about his background, because again, he's heavily autobiographical, and then Sleepwalk With Me is so fucking fantastic.
Oh my God. Jesus. Yeah, I saw that when he was doing it in New York, off Broadway, and then when the movie came out, and it's just so good, both versions, live stage version and the movie.
No, I bet. So, but it was just straight up one man show for the Broadway thing, right? Just him, just so. It's just so weird. How is that different from him doing stand up live? I mean, how does it differ? Is it? I mean, it's just more. I'll let you tell it. I'm not gonna assume.
Yeah. Well, I guess the main difference. There's, stand-up, it's very fast-paced, and punchlines, and I was kind of keeping track. In between the stories, he'd have, shorter bits, which would kind of up the number of punchlines. But when it's, a one-man show or a storytelling show where he's even just telling, a short, maybe 10 or 15-minute story, it kind of ebbs and flows, and it works more like a theater piece where there's dramatic moments where the audience is not laughing, but then something will happen and they'll laugh, and it's kind of this journey where it's still comedy, but it doesn't have to, you don't feel like, wait, why am I laughing? This is boring. Right. This is all set up. Mm-hmm. You know what I mean?
Yeah.
His setups are too long. With the one-man show, and he's really good at that, he's really able to kind of weave the dramatic parts in with the funny parts, which makes the funnier parts funny, because it's like you get the whole more of a realistic picture, I guess, of what's going on. I guess that's how I would
describe
the difference. I mean, the movie, for you, how does that differ from his stand-up, would you say? No,
that's a good point. It's so much, there's more to work with, because, again, you can cut, you can make it look really pretty, which it does. It's a very visually beautiful movie. So it feels probably more fast-paced than it is, and anything that, quote-unquote, might have been build-up, in a live show, is build-up with, again, I'm an American male, so I like things to distract me and be shiny, so it's, while it's building up, so it's more comparable, I feel like, to stand-up, because it's multimedia, it's keeping my attention more.
Right.
Maybe. And because I don't go and see enough theater, I probably would have a little more trouble with a one-man show. I'd go see it because I like him.
If it was a comedian, I bet you would do... I remember seeing Marc Maron's one-man show. Mm-hmm. And there is... The ones who do stand-up and do one-man shows, they kind of know how to get that audience as well. And it does feel... And it is... it's much like a stand-up special would be. It's not like there was, set pieces or anything.
Right.
There was a set design behind him. It almost looked like a special.
Of course. Yeah.
And there's a stool and a bottle of water, and he's just going, and he's kind of acting out stuff.
Right.
And going here and there. But.
And I do like that. I saw Kelly Carlin was on the podcast a year or a year and a half ago, and I got to go see her one woman show about growing up in, George Carlin's house. And it was amazing. And really beautiful and very emotional. And while she doesn't come from a stand up background, I finally saw the appeal of one person shows, and I'm like, I get that. But what I don't get, though, is, and you can maybe tell me better as a stand-up with a theater background, what is the appeal? Because I talk to a lot of stand-ups who say, who are pure stand-ups, who they'll go and act, they'll do acting, but they're like, no, I'll never quit stand-up is my thing. And I feel like some people would just not bother doing a one-person show because they'd be like, well, that's distracting from my hour,
So
I wonder.
It depends on the type. It depends on the type of comedian.
Sure.
Because someone who's not a stand-up or not a storyteller comedian might have a harder time, a one-liner comic.
Mm-hmm.
My husband Dan does one-liners, and he has talked about doing a one-man show, but what would he do?
Uh-huh.
He's terrified to tell. All of his jokes are not even based in reality. How would that work?
That would be an amazing surreal show, though. Whatever it was.
Potentially, whatever he figured out.
Uh-huh.
I know. I encourage him to keep exploring.
Of course, of course.
Yeah.
But there is that fear there, I would imagine. Again, stepping outside of a comfort zone. But is it because of your theatrical background? Would you do a one-woman show?
Yeah, that's such a good question, because Dan's always telling me that I should work on that. And it's funny because when I look at Mike Birbiglia, he's got that amazing sleepwalking thing.
Uh-huh, yeah.
So what's my thing that's that amazing?
Sure.
Do you know what I mean? It's
yep.
I have stuff,
mm-hmm.
and and I've seen a lot of solo shows, and I've seen a lot of good ones. Most of them are terrible. Mm-hmm. Most of them are really bad. Yeah. It's a really difficult form of theater.
Sure.
And it's like people tend to not want to go see them either. Mm-hmm. So that's like a totally normal thing. So I think about it a lot, and maybe I should just like take one of those classes from the people who like are really good at those so I can actually generate. But I've had a hard time figuring out what mine would be, even though I am a storyteller.
Oh, you didn't have to. How are ya? Nice to see ya. John got my last name right. It's Birbiglia. Everyone gets it wrong. When telemarketers call, they'll be like, "Good afternoon, may I speak with Mr.?" Oh, man. Kabigaboo. So I just have to spell it on the phone like it's B as in boy, I-R, B again, I-G-L-I-A. I wish my last name were just boy. I'd be like, it's B as in boy, and then the rest of the word, boy. I'm Italian. My family's not real Italian. We're like Olive Garden Italian. Sometimes people come up to me, they'll be like, in Italy, it's pronounced Birbiglia. I'm like, in America, you're annoying. It's a hard name to have growing up. The kids would call me names like Birbiglebug and Birbibliography and faggot.
You know, put me on a storytelling lineup and I have 10 minutes to tell a story, great. Okay. But have an hour where it's like an arc where it's all connected and it doesn't feel pretentious in any way, or like, you know what I mean? I don't know.
Then how do you build off of your current life? You know, I mean, if especially if like, sometimes if you, you know, let's say you just got married or you just had a kid or something that happens, but you don't have any stories there yet. If all your stories are in the past, you know what I mean? I feel like sometimes we're in that creatively, we're like, we're waiting for the next thing to happen. And it's like, is it disingenuous to tell this older story? You know what I mean?
Well, yeah, you're touching on, I mean, full disclosure, I actually am taking a hiatus from stand-up because after doing it for about 5 years, I just was finding myself not as interested in performing. Okay. And I think my son is almost two, and it happened, I was really excited to stand-up right after he was born. I was ready to jump back in there and, like, reclaim my identity. But about 6 months after he was born, I realized that for a couple of months, every time I would get booked on a show, I would go through the same routine, which is immediately being flattered, oh, of course, I'd love to, and then the day before the show, being like, I don't want to do this. Maybe the show will get canceled.
Right.
Maybe they'll forget they booked me. And, like, it took me a couple of months every time I had a show to realize, okay, every time you get booked, you're hoping that the show will get canceled or they'll forget that they booked you. Maybe you don't want to do stand-up right now.
Right.
So, so I told myself, I'll go back when I miss it.
Sure.
And I don't miss it yet. Okay. But part of it was because I had a lot going on. I had a new baby, and there was a whole lot of stuff going on there. But I think a lot of it was actually my kind of identity as a person was changing, you know, like turning 30 as opposed to I was still like in my early 20s when I started doing stand-up. So it's just a very different, I feel like I latched onto this persona kind of similar to what Mike has. You know, he's this awkward guy.
Sure. Yeah.
And I was this naive girl from the Midwest who was living in a city, and whoa, was my mind blown.
Right.
And it was really working, and my stories filtered through that perception were felt really true to me, and they felt really relatable to the audience. But I felt like as I started to age, I guess, I maybe became less naive, so it felt a little put on.
Okay. Yeah, that makes sense. Yeah.
So I feel like if I go back to stand-up, there just has to be a tweak. I'm just not the friendly mid, you know what I mean?
Right.
I identify more as a city girl now. So.
Of course. Now, and if you hadn't had the quote-unquote time off, obviously you're very busy doing a lot of things, having a kid, but if you hadn't had that, I wonder, well, obviously the same change wouldn't have happened.
Sure.
I mean, obviously that's big. But if you hadn't been, if you didn't need to take that time off, it would have been interesting to see if you would have sort of gradually worked that in,
yeah.
or done a Carlin, which you know, again, he had a couple different transformations, but the, you know, the, like people like to say, like the black shirt and ponytail Carlin, like all of a sudden popped up, and you always sort of wonder if that evolution would be gradual or if you just decide one day, no, fuck it, this is new.
Yeah, market. I think for most stand-ups they do push through. I mean, mm-hmm. I know comedians have told me they've taken time off.
Of course,
it's funny,
yeah.
You don't notice it. It's like out of sight, out of mind. And mm-hmm. then they're back. And you're yeah. like, oh, where were you? Oh, great, you're back.
Mm-hmm.
You know what I mean?
Yeah.
So that is interesting. If I had pushed through it, I think I just couldn't ignore that
yeah.
feeling of, like, having zero desire to perform.
Of course, no,
so,
definitely. Yeah.
So maybe that will change. But I still definitely, I mean, I enjoy comedy.
Sure.
Dan does comedy. And I still like to go see comedy, you mm-hmm. know, when I can, and the people, great people,
of course,
doing
yeah.
stand-up in LA and all that stuff, and I love to do all that. It's
mm-hmm.
just, I don't want to wait too long. Like, I have a
sure.
lot of people who keep, just get back in it. Once you get back in it,
mm-hmm.
it's always hard when you take a break to get back in it.
Sure.
But, yeah, I'm having another kid in February, so I feel like
really?
I should at least wait
wait
till I do
yeah.
that.
Yeah, maybe now's not the time. Holy cow, that's insane.
Because I did I did stand up pregnant, like, the whole time when I was
mm-hmm.
pregnant with Sam, and it was hard, because I was
I
tired
bet.
At night.
I bet. Oh, my
you
goodness.
Know, but,
did you, okay, so before you decided stand-up was your thing, I mean, what was your, were you going to be in theater, were you going to perform, what happened before you kind of, the switch flipped?
Yeah, I was a theater kid
mm-hmm.
and a performer. That also makes it so weird that I suddenly have no desire to perform, because
right.
since I was three, that's been, like, constant.
Mm-hmm.
And I studied theater in college at the University of Oregon, and I moved to New York afterwards, but I didn't think that I'd be able to make it as an actor, mainly not because of talent.
Uh-huh.
I just feel like it was, I just felt like I couldn't afford to support that habit.
Sure.
Because I was meeting, I had done like a summer intensive at NYU one summer where I was getting to meet all these people who were going to NYU, and it was like their parents were paying for their fancy, you know, Soho apartments
yeah.
and funding their lives. And I'm like, well, that, and so they can just take unlimited acting classes
uh-huh.
and they don't have to have a day job, so they can just audition all day. And
mm-hmm.
I moved to New York, and in order to make my rent, I had to, like, work 60 hours a week at three different customer service jobs.
Cool.
So I was like, okay, that's just really hard.
Mm-hmm.
But then I ended up getting a job, with some Broadway producers, Richard Frankel Productions, that would do, like, these big Broadway shows, and
mm-hmm.
I was working in their general management area,
mm-hmm.
which is kind of how that translates to how I'm working at the Zephyr now.
Mm-hmm.
And I loved that, and I thought that was the path for me.
Sure.
Until I started dating a stand-up comedian. Not Dan, but a different one.
Uh-huh.
And it was just mind-blowing, because it was like, oh, wait, so these open mics, most of them are free.
Mm-hmm.
It's your own schedule. You don't have to worry
right.
about, you know, scheduling your work schedule around it. It's just like, oh, I don't have to work right now, so
sure.
I'll go do an open mic. And so it was this creative outlet that I could afford
mm-hmm.
and still, like, work my day job and that sort of thing. So that's kind of the long way that I got to.
That's crazy.
Trying stand up.
I mean, it doesn't sound necessarily atypical, but it is obvious. The idea of beating yourself up to just make a living, and then also just like, no, I have to. You must have had a lot to let out. And I mean, you're in New York City, and I've never lived in the city. I'm from upstate New York, but I've never lived in the city. I can't fathom 60 hours of work in that city. And then,
yeah,
and
it
then,
didn't. That period of time did not last for very long.
Okay.
I feel like it was 2 months
mm-hmm.
of 60 hours a week, and then I got the producer job that was 40
that's,
hours a week,
oh,
and that was
nice.
More manageable.
Yeah.
And that was just totally luck, because
mm-hmm.
I was getting burnout fast, and I loved the city. I just didn't know what I was going to do, because
sure.
I was just so tired all
mm-hmm.
the time. Working that cafe job that starts at 6:30 in the morning.
Mm-hmm.
And, you
oh,
know,
that's so
all
gross.
That. Yeah.
Mm-mm. So where were you coming from originally? Where were you? Where'd you grow up?
I grew up in Iowa.
Okay.
In Davenport, Iowa.
All right. So, yeah, New York City's a shock. Though,
yeah.
I imagine.
Yeah, but I would go there. My dad worked in the newspaper industry, and they'd always have a couple of conferences in New York, mm-hmm. and he traveled so much for his job, the mm-hmm. rule was, like, we could skip school and go on
that's
trips
awesome.
With him
oh,
if
amazing.
We wanted to.
Yeah.
And so if it was New York or Orlando, Florida, I was always in,
that's
and then
great.
Maybe he could talk me into a couple others.
Wow.
So it was, I would usually get to go to New York once a year, mm-hmm. see a couple shows.
Yeah.
So that's kind of how I fell in love with New York. And when I moved there, I was, like, never planning on leaving.
Right. Was theater, I mean, what was your exposure to theater before getting a chance to actually go see it in the best place to see theater? I mean, were your parents exposing you to stuff?
Well, I was a big Broadway musical fan, mm-hmm. and the only thing that I could watch the Rosie O'Donnell show.
Mm-hmm.
She would have the cast for various shows, and I would, like, go to school, but I'd have a VHS tape set to record
mm-hmm.
Rosie O'Donnell so that I would make sure that if there was a Broadway cast, I could, like,
awesome.
You know, have that. And I would buy, with my allowance, like, every Broadway CD that would come out so I could
great.
Be knowledgeable. It was weird. It was a lonely thing because none of the other kids were doing
of
that.
Of course,
on
yeah.
that. I was just, you know, and I would throw Tony Awards parties every year.
That's awesome.
In middle school.
That's
and
amazing.
High school. And go to the grocery store and order a cake that they and have them write, like, Tony Awards 1997.
That is, you know? Awesome.
It was fun. No one else quite got it. I mean, they came to the parties for
sure,
cake.
Of course.
Free cake. But, but I did theater. I did children's theater.
Mm-hmm.
There was, like, a local children's theater in the area that I was really involved with, and
mm-hmm.
that was my first job. Working there and teaching, like, dance and acting classes and
mm-hmm.
working in the costume shop. And then in high school, I'd do all the high school plays.
Sure.
So I wanted to be a rapper when I was a kid. It surprises people because I'm a cracker. I'm a cracker-ass white bread honky. That's right. I like using the word cracker a little in my act because a lot of black comics use the N-word. I like using the C word. Like, me and my cracker friends were driving down the street in my Volvo station wagon. And I said, "Hey, cracker, pass the sun chips." And he says, "Not till we get to the picnic, cracker." And I say, "Cracker, please." He's like, "Cracker, what?" But I said that at a show, and this black guy comes up to me, and he was like, "My cracker." And I was like, "Actually, you can't call me a cracker. Only we can call each other crackers. You can say cracker, but not cracker." He was like, "It's okay, I got white friends and they're cool with it," so I cooled down.
Were you exposed? I mean, what was comedy like in your house? Were there comedy albums? Was it just watching TV? Did you share it with your family? What was it like?
Yeah, no comedy albums. I actually get a little jealous of the comedians who have the really, like, historical, they knew they wanted to be a stand-up from the time they were five. But lots of comedy. My parents would let me watch whatever, so
mm-hmm.
we, you know, I'd watch all the sitcoms and, you know, The Simpsons and stuff like
mm-hmm.
that. And then I did see stand-up comedy once in Iowa by accident. My dad, I think I was, like, probably nine, and my
uh-huh.
sister was seven, and my dad was in town for the weekend, so he was looking for something fun for us to do
mm-hmm.
as a family, and there was, like, going to be a clown at this place, so we're going to go check out the clown.
Uh-huh.
And it was at this place, it was at this bar called the Rusty Nail. And it was, I mean, I just remember, because my dad pretended like everything was fine.
Uh-huh.
You know what I mean? Just like, we're here.
Uh-huh.
We're just not going to even mention that this is totally weird.
Oh,
so we go into this bar, it's like at 3 o'clock in the afternoon, and it's in the basement, and, you know, you can still smoke in bars, so
sure.
I remember, I had never, like, I couldn't breathe the cigarette smoke. It's a 7-year-old and a 9-year-old. I really don't think it was billed as a stand-up comedy show, but it was, I just remember it was these, like, older guys in their 40s telling really raunchy things, saying these things that I knew I wasn't supposed to hear, my dad pretending it wasn't happening,
uh-huh.
and then at the end there was a clown. Just like...
Oh my
like
God.
A regular clown who, like, pulled a quarter out of my ear or whatever, and I remember just thinking, That was so weird.
That would scar most people.
Yeah. I mean, I just was, it was just kind of like that. I acknowledged that my dad probably knew that was inappropriate, but we didn't need to discuss it.
No, of course not. Holy crap.
So, wow. So that was the first time I ever saw stand-up, and then I didn't see it again until I was in New York, right my senior year. Mm-hmm. I went with my dad, and I brought one of my friends from high school, and we went to Caroline's, mm-hmm. and Judah Friedlander was hosting, Dane Cook was featuring, and I have no idea who the headliner was, which is so interesting, because that was just like when those guys were still kind of coming
up.
Sure,
sure.
Yeah, so it was just kind of interesting.
That's
yeah.
crazy. Do you know, I mean, is there a first show that you can remember being aware of, like a Broadway show that just all of a sudden was like, oh, this is the most amazing thing I've ever seen?
Like Broadway show, Les Miserables.
Yeah.
I was heavy into Les Mis.
How were you exposed to that first, though?
My parents went and saw it in New York, mm-hmm. and bought the CD at intermission, okay. and they brought it home. And so that was the first cast recording that we had, mm-hmm. and I would play it all the time. And
that's
I
awesome.
Staged a version on my porch.
Oh my
that
god!
That was like 3 hours long with a bunch of other kids between the ages of 5 and 9.
That's amazing.
And I played all the girl parts, and then they of could course. Play all the boy parts. So
that's got to be one of those shows, though, that you can listen to and you picture the whole thing in your head, right?
I mean, yeah.
Yeah, that's got to be why it's so thick.
Yeah,
there's just so
definitely.
Much going on in it.
And I just knew it so well.
Mm-hmm.
So I've seen that a bunch, and it's funny. I like took. I took Dan to see it,
mm-hmm.
When it was in LA like a couple years ago, and he's not a musical theater guy.
Uh-huh.
Mainly, actually, interestingly enough, he cannot understand lyrics when they're sung.
Mm-hmm.
It's really weird. Like, he just doesn't hear the lyrics. He just can't process them. He hears the music, but mm-hmm. but it sounds like gibberish or another language. And so I take him to Les Mis, and I'm like, you should at least let me give you a synopsis, because you're going to be so lost.
Right.
He's like, no spoilers.
Oh, shit.
All right. So I took him to see Les Mis, and he sat through the whole thing afterwards, and I was like, so what'd you think? And he's like, I didn't understand a word. And I was like, well, but yeah, but you could see what was going on the stage. Like, you know, when the kid gets shot, how sad that was. He's like, there was a kid? I was like, oh, no. That was the worst 3 hours of your life. Good luck getting you to ever go to another musical.
Oh, my God. That's
actually, so
funny.
Far, I have not.
And that's funny, too, because I sometimes I try not to force anybody's hand, and I always do like to ask, oh, did you make friends over comedy? But obviously, like, and you grew up more with theater was your thing.
Yeah.
And you probably did make some friends through theater, I have to imagine.
Yeah. Oh, mm-hmm. definitely. Yeah. I mean, lifelong friends from that children's theater.
Mm-hmm.
I've got my buddy, one of the guys that he now runs the children's theater,
oh,
which
awesome.
Is so cute.
That's
so
amazing.
You know, whenever I'm back in Davenport, I always have to visit that.
Mm-hmm.
And, yeah, and then, you know, all my college friends are my college theater buddies.
Yeah.
That sort of thing. And then in New York, the company that I was producing with, you know, I have friends from working there.
Mm-hmm.
So that's a very tight group. But comedy, I mean, I threw myself into that. I mean,
yeah.
I have a lot of very close comedian friends as well, just because it's very similar to theater in that,
sure.
well, actually, comedy is a smaller world than theater.
Mm-hmm.
I feel like theater, I guess maybe, oh, I hate to call it a dying art form or whatever, but mm-hmm. it's harder to get younger people to go to the theater.
Sure, especially out here.
Especially out here, yeah. That's true. I mean, it's more expensive than comedy.
Mm-hmm.
There's a lot of different things at play, you know, why that would be. But I feel like you make friends when you're in a show together. But with comedy, it's just this small circle where everybody knows everybody, and you're
mm-hmm.
just seeing, you're making friends because you're at open mics together,
mm-hmm.
and you're at shows together.
Right.
And that sort of thing. So, so I'm still, because, do you know who Zach Sherwin is?
Yes.
Yeah. So mm-hmm. he and I were running a show at Tech's forever. It's still going on.
Mm-hmm.
I just have stepped back.
Okay.
and just look on and, mm-hmm. And come sometimes for the good French food and wine. Mm-hmm. And he runs that with Jim Hagerty now. But that's just, you know, a nice show where people pop in. Even if they're not on the show, they come to hang sure. out and that kind of thing.
Yeah, I mean, it is a different atmosphere, I guess. Was it shocking for you when you first got into comedy? Or was it kind of easy to move into that for you, that kind of camaraderie? Was it similar, or was it...
Yeah, I think different? It was... I mean, I think I was kind of naive, which helped me a mm-hmm. little bit not be scared or intimidated.
Okay, yeah.
But New York, it's very tough. It's very cutthroat. It's interesting, because if I were to take, you know, just tally, like, this is just... Honestly, I mean, the LA comedians and the New York comedians in general, I mean, of course there are LA comedians who work really hard and everything, mm-hmm. but it is like a claw your way to the top right. kind of environment in New York, mm-hmm. which makes you work hard or not do it.
Sure.
It's your only option. Yeah. In LA, you have two choices. You could work hard, or you can kind of like coast along uh-huh. and hang out, and like mm-hmm. the audiences are a little easier in LA because everybody's just feeling good. New York, they are a little bit sharper. They maybe see more comedy, sure. so you have to be really on your game. So in a way, New York was a great place to start, and because I was so naive, I wasn't afraid of it. Mm-hmm. I just jumped in and was working really hard and That's making crazy. Sure I was getting up every night and you know, all of that. And it was interesting because when I moved to LA, I moved because Dan was based in LA, and then he had a writing job in New York, which is how we met, and he stayed in New York as long as he could. I mean, I explained to him I never wanted to leave New York for the rest of my life. I loved it so much. But it was just, he needed to be based in LA. Mm-hmm. I mean, he was, you know, he'd have job interviews for writing jobs for like a show like 30 Rock, which was in New York, but he had to fly to LA for the meeting. It just, he had to be based in LA. I mean, there are comedians that do it, but they have to do that. And it's just like... So I had to think about it, and I was like, you know what? I'm going to try it. I'm going to try moving to LA. And it felt a little unfair because here I was kind of, you know, at the bottom of the pile doing the whole claw my way up. And when you claw your way up to the top of the pile in New York, that's when you're at the top of the pile, so you move to LA. So it felt a little unfair that I was like, okay, bye, guys. I'm moving to LA.
Right.
Didn't really, you know, climb all the way up there yet, but it'll be fine. And it was. I mean, I moved to LA, and the comedians were so nice and welcoming and supportive in a way that the New York comedians really weren't. Not because, I mean, everybody was friends. Mm-hmm. It just, it was just a little, it was just a little harsher. I guess.
That's the impression I always get, but I mean, that's the impression you get of anything in LA versus New York. I mean, again, being from the East Coast, I actually miss... I'm from upstate, which, by the way, is as, like, redneck as you can get. Now, that's not an insult, necessarily. It's just very rural.
Yeah.
The accent is the same as it is down south. It's very similar. So, but even living there in what should be, like, pastoral and relaxed, no, the weather makes you a certain way.
Yeah.
And it is very, it's just harsh to live there. It's not easy to live. So I completely get that. So, you know, I moved out here 11 years ago, and I felt like I immediately got lazy. And I'm like, no, you got to work hard. And I still have that, but I also totally understand that change where it's like, oh, this is, they don't expect much of me. That's how it sort of feels, you know? So I think you sort of have to work hard in a different way. And I don't know if I could verbalize how that is, but it is a different expectation.
Right. I will, the LA comedians are more like, entrepreneurial. They like come up with these great ideas. Oh, well, I want a tour, so I'll just make my own tour. I think that's a really cool thing that a lot of up and coming LAs, and so they're getting road experience that way.
Mm-hmm.
So I think that's good. But for the New York comedian, it's just like, you know, pounding the pavement and just doing as many sets in a night and just getting as good as you can, and you don't move to LA until you're there. Mm-hmm. And it does pay off for them.
Oh,
it really
course.
Does.
Yeah.
It's very impressive.
Yeah.
The ones that you know have been working so hard at it.
I love being back in D.C. I lived here for a while. I love it here, man. Oh, thanks a lot. That's real nice. I live in New York City right now. I got an apartment. It's a little bigger than my body, and My friend came over to give me advice. He's like, you got to get nice little hand soap for your bathroom. Women love that. And I was like, do they also love it when your shower's 1 foot from your toaster? Because I got that going on too. I saw a mouse in my apartment the other day. I leaned over. I was like, where are you going to sleep? I got a great building, though. I got my own drug dealer for the building. So every time I walk out my door, the same guy tries to sell me drugs. So, like, I'm walking out in the morning to get a Snapple. And this guy will be like, you want weed? You want smoke? And I'm like, do you have any Snapple? Because I think he should also sell Snapple. That way he hooks you in with the Snapple.
It's not easy. Most people, I mean, I'm sure that there are examples of people who don't work hard and make it in
sure,
comedy,
it happens,
but it's pretty rare.
Mm-hmm.
So
when you first started, like you said, it was around 2006. Is that what you said, around the time of this album?
Yes, it. I started in the summer of 2007, but
The
comedian that I was dating was a huge fan of Mike Birbiglia, and so this was an album. He's like, you have to listen.
Yeah.
And he, because I didn't have a stand up history, it was really nice. He would, like, kind of introduce me, oh, you have to listen to this, you have to, you don't know who Louis C.K. is, okay, we gotta, you know, we gotta work on this, and I was literally starting from scratch.
That's awesome, though.
I know, it's crazy that was not that long ago, that I didn't know who these people are that,
of course,
are, you know, that are really important
sure.
In the industry, or industry, stand-up industry, in the community that I was, you know, frequenting, and still frequent, you know,
sure.
for such a long time. It's just kind of bizarre.
Yeah.
It's like that when you discover that this whole other world, you know, exists.
It's cool to want to do it, though, for that completely different reason, and still be, and still enjoy it, and still have people, you know, you must be good, otherwise people wouldn't keep welcoming you back, you know what I'm saying?
Right.
So, it's interesting that you would be, you know, what one assumes is a naturally gifted comedian, but also, again, coming from this completely different perspective is kind of cool, because you learn about, you get that, I think you get that excitement, because comedians sometimes will be like, oh, you don't, oh, here's the, get excited, that's why I do this podcast. It's like, oh, you don't know who this is, here, take the album.
Yeah.
You know, there is that excitement, to be able to take advantage of that from, like, as many angles is probably pretty great.
Yeah.
You know, you're starting out on this new thing, it's like, oh, no, listen to this. So did you end up buying that album, or did he just have it, in, or was this, like, the first, like, I'm curious what the first comedy album you bought was then, like,
on your own. Yeah. That's a really good question. I mean, it was probably one of my friends, because those are the comedy albums I buy.
Sure,
the one, you know, when a friend releases an album, then I buy that. I don't know what the order would be.
Okay, yeah.
So he probably lent me Two Drink Mike, I'm guessing.
Yeah.
Because he had it.
And you said you listened to it just a ton.
Yeah. I mean, I don't feel like I had it memorized.
Right.
But I would see him a lot. Mm-hmm. The one thing I will say about stand-up albums, it's really interesting, maybe everyone's like this, but it's actually harder for me to listen to albums and watch specials because I so strongly prefer to see live comedy.
Okay, sure.
It makes such a difference for me.
Mm-hmm.
Maybe it's the live theater thing.
Mm-hmm.
It's not that I don't, you know, enjoy albums or whatever, but I don't... I think that's maybe one of the reasons why when I started doing stand-up, I didn't jump on the, okay, now I have to learn my history,
of
and
course.
I have to,
yeah.
I mean, I still should have, because that's a very valuable thing to do
sure.
if you're going to, you know, learn who came before and who's doing what now. But it really, I mean, I would say I wasn't doing stand-up yet, but I would listen to these albums with my boyfriend at the time and, you know, get really into it. But my favorite was when we would go and see those people in New York and see them live.
Do you have a favorite track off of this album, though? Is there something on here that stands out as, like, a favorite? Not a favorite track. That's silly. Favorite joke, though. I mean, you know.
Yeah, I should have thought...
Don't worry. I sometimes... Some people don't expect that question because it's not a music album.
No, but I mean, you know, people have their favorite jokes, and
It's actually easier for me, I think, because I haven't listened to it a lot.
Yeah.
So what it's easy for me to make it. That's really difficult. And I'm now pouring water into a cup, which is incredibly loud. But, you know, I will say, just on an artistic level, I think the reason I brought up the George Bush one is because it snuck up on you.
Yeah.
And actually, I didn't even. What was the one that I like ones that I don't catch at first. There was a joke. He made an amazing joke that shouldn't have snuck up on me. Sweetheart, I'm so sorry. Do you remember what the joke was? The joke that snuck up on me that you got immediately, and I was like, and it took the audience. It was a slow burn for the audience and then also for me, and I felt kind of dumb for it.
Oh.
It's going to be really great. I'll cut this part out.
It was one of the Lincoln quotes. Well, we already bought tickets.
Yes, yeah. Somehow, because I was busy cleaning, I'll use that as an excuse, that we already bought tickets line. It's just the whole bit about, you know, why, does every mundane saying have to get, can just anybody have a mundane saying attributed to them? Does it have to be Lincoln gets attributed to everything?
That was one a really good bit. That one took me a second, too. Uh-huh. Yeah. But then once you do, yeah, uh-huh. I laughed out loud. Yeah.
It's so good. And I think it's also different, too, with a storytelling comedian. Like, if you're trying to nail down a joke, it's sometimes slow burns. And the thing that doesn't stand out is necessarily each punchline. It's just this whole, you know, the whole picture that they paint.
Right. Yeah, I mean, I like the stuff, you know, towards the beginning of the album when he's setting up his awkward persona and mm-hmm. how he's awkward.
Yeah.
So that ends up being the... You know, what I should have said was nothing, and mm-hmm. all of that stuff.
That's a really good, that's a good button.
I like that, and it reminds me so much of what, you know, I was always trying to do in my con. I don't even mm-hmm. think I was necessarily realizing that I was kind of paralleling, you know, his style as much as I was. I knew he was a storyteller but, I mean, I think there were a lot of similarities.
Sure.
It's also interesting that at the end of the album, he does the music thing.
I know!
Which was so popular mm-hmm. in, like, 2005. What year was the Comedians of Comedy... No, Zach Galifianakis at the piano, that famous...
Oh, yeah, yeah,
do you know
yeah.
what I'm talking about?
The Purple Onion? His Purple Onion?
Yes. Yeah, that was probably in the early 2000s. Was it 2007?
I could be. I was watching it the other day and was actually
I feel like that was one of the things I saw before I started doing stand-up. So mm-hmm. it might have been 2006. But it was like, at the time, you know, Nick Thune was doing that a mm-hmm. lot, and Dimitri Martin, and I remember when I started doing stand-up, it was officially not okay to do that anymore.
Okay, yeah.
Like, you weren't allowed to be, it was like there were enough talented musical comedians mm-hmm. that you weren't allowed to just get your guitar out and strum in the background, and that was suddenly considered hacky. Not the people who had kind of been developing it mm-hmm. as this thing, it was just interesting that there were so many comedians doing that.
Yeah.
At the same time. And now you don't really see it. Like, even Dimitri Martin has kind of gone away from that. And Nick, I mean, at least the last several times I've seen Nick Thune. Yeah, it just kind of, you just move on from that. But for a period of time, it was, you know, really blowing people's minds. And
sure.
So I was thinking about that. I was like, oh, and Mike Birbiglia got in on the musical comedy thing with a couple songs at the end.
Yeah, it kind of shocked me, but at least the one thing I think that was still satisfying about it is, like, he's not trying to say that he's good at guitar. He's like, he's like, obviously I'm doing the same thing over and over again.
Yeah, he says he learned it this year. He learned how to play the guitar this year. So maybe he was trying to jump on the bandwagon of people are loving this guitar thing. But I don't think he does that anymore. At least.
I would hope not.
Yeah.
I mean, he's just so much more interesting on his own.
Yeah. No, I agree. But that's the interesting thing. You got to try out all the styles and see what fits.
Mm-hmm.
But yeah, I had forgotten that was even part of it. And then,
when you come back, I think you should just sneakily try and start a harmonica thing. Just make stand-ups think that they have to have a harmonica with them at all times.
Yeah.
And then have them learn the most annoying. I love the harmonica, but it would be so obnoxious if there are like 10 comedians in a row all with harmonicas. It would just be a nice prank, so just consider that.
somebody must have tried that, right? But I don't know who it was.
Well, you know what? I can tell you Robert Klein did a bit on this album that Paul Provenza wanted to talk about. He nailed it. He did a great uh-huh. job, but he only used a harmonica and it had a purpose, you know.
Yes.
He was talking about old war movies and how they always had a harmonica in the back. It was great.
Yeah.
You know, the crack a bit on this is really, really, really funny. And I remember that's one of the reasons I didn't want to listen to him at the time, because I had, with my friends, not on stage, had been doing the same bit for a long time.
Oh.
I'm like, you son of a bitch, you quote-unquote stole my bit. And I'm not going to listen to this guy. And then eventually I saw the special, I'm like, I should have been listening to this guy. Damn it. Like, I've done that to myself several times where I feel like, oh, no, they're doing my bit, but I'm not doing anything with it. You can't get angry at that.
Right.
You know?
Yeah, because he, I mean, he kind of weaves that throughout the album.
That's so good.
Kraka and White Bread and all of that
so
stuff.
Silly.
And he really kind of explains that, yeah, he's that guy that, you know, TSA is not worried about. He can kind of say whatever he wants.
Right.
Yeah.
Oh, my God. Yeah, it's really, it's a really tight album, and it is really funny, though, to still compare it to, again, if that's only 8 years ago, how much better a stand-up he already is.
Right.
8 years?
Oh, yeah.
I don't understand that. I don't know what it is. I mean, it could be because he does so many different types of things.
I mean, I think he's, like, in his mid-30s, so, yeah, he was, like, in his 20s at the time.
Mm-hmm.
And, I mean, it is, I mean, he is on the road all the time. As a stand-up, he's so busy.
Yeah.
He's so good. Yeah, I was producing a show in New York for a couple years while I was there called Hold for the Laughs, and it was a benefit for indie theater companies.
Mm-hmm.
So it was basically like my worlds colliding.
That's awesome.
A little bit. And it was really great because theater audiences are amazing stand-up audiences.
Really?
I think maybe because plays that are supposed to be funny aren't really that funny usually.
Oh, yeah. Sure.
And so like anything that's like kind of funny, it gets this huge laugh. So when you put like a comedian on stage, they lose their minds.
That's
I mean, you've never seen anybody laugh so hard in your life as a theater audience. So it was a really great show, but I wanted to get Mike Birbiglia on it so much. And I would I tracked down his email and I was always getting in touch. He always would write back the nicest thing, but it was always, he was on tour.
I'm single right now. I realized, oh, thanks. Actually, it's my girlfriend. I'm sorry, I apologize. No, I realized recently I needed to find a woman who loves me for my money, doesn't understand math that well. Yeah. I used to think I was a little unstable, and then I met every girl I've ever dated, and now I think I'm fine. Yeah, like, they kind of keep it under wraps for a while. Everything seems cool. About 2 months in, they're like, maybe this weekend we could. I'm crazy! And they blow away like a tumbleweed. And I'm like, come back, come back!
It's interesting because from producing and doing stand-up, like, it's a small community. I've met, like, a lot of comedians
Sure.
who I, you know, consider, you know, greats and heroes and
mm-hmm.
that sort of thing. But I had never met Mike Birbiglia until, like, last month,
really?
Randomly. I was at John Mulaney's wedding, because
mm-hmm.
Dan writes for his show, and they're good friends. So, it was so weird, because he sat down next to me
mm-hmm.
at the rehearsal dinner, and I got, like, kind of nervous.
That's
like
awesome.
Like I had to remind myself, you know, to be cool.
Of course. Sure.
But I feel like that doesn't happen that often anymore
right.
around comedy, but it's because I'd never met him and
mm-hmm.
that was, I think, when I realized, I think that was right before you got in touch with me to do this.
Mm-hmm.
And I think that's one of the things that made me realize I wanted to talk about Mike Birbiglia, because it was like, oh, clearly you had an effect on me.
Yeah.
I'm getting like, you know,
awesome.
Play it cool, and you know, and I ended up talking to him and casually, oh yeah, you know, I brought Dan to see Sleepwalk with me, and
mm-hmm.
he's like, oh, I'm doing another show in LA, you should come, and like,
mm-hmm.
really, just, I mean, he's such a nice guy, he's so talented,
yeah.
but yeah, I mean, he's married, but he's still just going, I don't think he has kids, I guess, I have no idea, I didn't talk to him about much more than comedy,
right.
but, or for very long, but I can't remember how many cities he said he was doing on this tour, but he's just on the road all the time. It's very impressive. I mean, clearly, you know, he's a storyteller who is dedicated to the stand-up format.
Right.
As much as, if not more, I mean, I think he's just kind of one of those superhuman guys who
mm-hmm.
can just do everything.
He's got this interesting presence where I feel like there's a certain segment of the American population where Actually, I think with most comics, you'd be like, you could say a stand-up's name, and they could be super famous-ish, and that person would not know who you're talking about, but you tell them a bit, and they'd be like, oh, I know that guy you're talking about.
Yeah.
And I feel like he might be one of those guys who, like, again, in the comedy world, he's huge. He's had a great... He released a great movie. He's on This American Life, so he's got a huge... He's got this other rep. But I am shocked that... I don't know if it's all him, but, you know, that he hasn't had a sitcom. I don't know if it's, like, Mark... He doesn't want to, or if it's just, like... He's such a stand-up that, yeah. You know what I mean?
You know, I think he did have one in development. Mm-hmm. I don't know why I know that. Mm-hmm. I mean, most comedians at that level at least have had that.
You would think
that.
So, right.
It's just such a random, luck thing. Mm-hmm. If your pilot actually gets made.
Of course.
It becomes a series.
No matter how big you are, it's very weird.
I think there was a network developing something, mm-hmm. and their loss, as far as I'm concerned.
Absolutely.
Do you watch Girls?
I don't have HBO.
So I really like that show a lot. Mm-hmm. But he has, like, a guest star part of it.
Really?
And he's a really good actor. I mean, he's a really good actor in Sleepwalking.
Yeah.
So I think, yeah, hopefully it's only a matter of time.
I saw him in the other day? Cedar Rapids, that's what I saw.
Oh, I haven't seen that.
He's
is
briefly
that good?
In that. It is. It's upsetting. Yeah. It's really good, but it's more upsetting than I thought it was going to
yeah.
be. Because it's a goofy comedy, but there's some dark shit in it.
Yeah. Yeah, I guess I don't know too much about that movie, but I...
It's worth watching, I think.
Worth watching.
Yeah, and he's just like an attendant at a hotel desk, but he eats it up. Like, he's good. He's only got like 10 minutes, no, maybe 5 minutes of film. And he's great.
Yeah.
He's great to watch.
Yeah.
So.
Yeah, he's really talented. So. And it turns out, I didn't know this beforehand because I only just met him a month ago, but he's a very nice guy. Which is always nice to hear,
yes,
isn't it?
Yes, it is. Yeah.
It's always like, I hate when someone you think is really funny is just an asshole.
Uh-huh.
You know? It's disappointing.
It does. It is. Sometimes you catch him on the wrong day. I interviewed somebody on the podcast the other day who... I really admire, and who...
Oh,
no. At first, I thought, I came to their house, and they turned me away, like, I don't have time, sorry. And I'm like, I'm here with the podcast? And they said, oh, you're with the podcast, I'm so sorry. I thought you were somebody coming around for this survey that I did not want to take, that I told them to come back tomorrow. They felt horrible.
Yeah.
They felt so horrible. You catch them in the wrong thing, you know. And if they're, you know, yeah.
Oh,
it's funny.
Yeah,
you know, we're artists. We can be temperamental.
That is true.
But sometimes it's for the right reasons.
There are some people who just have a lot of wrong days, though.
Of course,
that.
Of course. Like, yeah, no, I've seen that. You know, I've worked in production. That's why
right.
I don't work in production anymore.
Right.
No, fuck that. I'm not dealing with that. No, absolutely not.
Yeah.
Oh my God. Okay, so I always like to ask people towards the end if you're going to recommend this album as you know, to somebody who doesn't know Mike Birbiglia, who's maybe not a big stand-up person. What's a good way to condense why it's a good album to listen to?
Well, it's a great, it's a great example of how storytelling can work, with stand-up comedy. Mm-hmm. I mean, it's like, he knows the rules of stand-up comedy. I mean, if there are rules, there mm-hmm. kind of are. You
sure.
just, you have to have a lot of laughs or mm-hmm. dies.
Mm-hmm.
And so I just feel like he's really great and he takes a lot of risk. I mean, you can hear, you know... He's gauging the audience's reaction.
Mm-hmm.
It's not like a perfectly polished album.
Sure.
And I like that. It feels like a live show that you would see a comedian do.
Yeah.
That at the end of it, you were like, oh, that was great. But then, you know, some jokes hit harder than others. But then maybe some of the ones that didn't hit as hard maybe hit better
mm-hmm.
in a different town. Like that sort of thing.
Right.
But I feel like his persona is really strong and consistent. And... He just is really funny. I mean, I do believe, and you never know because different comedians have different opinions on whether it needs to be mostly truthful or
sure,
made up.
Sure.
But I really believe everything that's coming out of his mouth when he 100%, says that.
100%.
I believe that all of those things happen to him just the way he says.
Mm-hmm.
And so it's a great example of selling that.
That's a good point. It's a good example of his acting. I mean, that's mm-hmm. not all stand-ups are good actors.
Right.
You know? I mean, you know, there are great stand-ups who can be one-liner comedians and still turn out, oh, no, they can also actually emote on cue. But, you know, some people can't.
Yeah.
You know, and, yeah, that's a good point. This is, it's really solid in that you emotionally are with him the whole way. You know, same as you're with him through Sleepwalk with me for a much different reason.
Yeah.
But totally different. Like, I think it'd be great to listen to this and then jump to Sleepwalk with me and just be like, holy shit, this is the same guy. Like, they're
right.
so different.
Right.
But phenomenal.
Yeah. Yeah, because this was, like, one of his first albums.
Mm-hmm.
One of... pretty early. Because, yeah, he taped it in 2005.
Yeah.
And it came out in 2006. So...
Oh, yes, and I was looking. The Zach Galifianakis Live with the Purple Onion was the same year, 2006.
So, oh, wow.
Yeah. So,
I think that was just the year when musical comedy just went, wow.
I know. Yeah. It's so weird, too, about just not to get on another comedian for too much, but like, I was shocked. It was shortly after that where Zach Galifianakis was no longer known as a stand-up. But, I mean, you know, I was watching him, again, never live, but watching him on Conan back in the day when he was... Nobody knew who the fuck this guy was.
Yeah.
And I remember... Well, first of all, his name stood out. I would never forget that last name.
Yeah.
But, like, yeah, I was shocked where all of a sudden I would see him places not with a piano, not doing stand-up stuff. I'm like, oh, that's weird. Like,
right.
And I haven't seen him live ever, so I don't have any idea what he does now. I'm very curious.
Right.
What his act is. I've never seen it.
Yeah. Yeah, I saw him at UCB.
Mm-hmm.
I can't remember. I mean, he wasn't playing the piano mm-hmm. anymore.
Yeah.
Just doing bits. It was funny.
Yeah.
I don't know if I can accurately describe what the style was, right. But it was great. I mean, he's really talented.
Yeah. All right, so where can we find you online, et cetera, et cetera, et cetera, because you're still active tweeter and all that stuff.
Yeah, right? Yeah. Yay. I'm, yeah, I'm Margie Mintz. Margie Mintz at, on Twitter and on Facebook. And,
mm-hmm.
Yeah.
Do you have any shows coming up here, like, that you're working on?
I'm producing, it's a drama.
Mm-hmm. It's okay.
But it opened last night at the Zephyr.
Uh-huh.
And, it's called Low Hanging Fruit.
Mm-hmm.
And it's a drama about homeless female war veterans living in Los Angeles.
Really?
It's a really good play. It's mm-hmm. heavy. And there are some funny parts, so.
That's good.
So people should check it out. It runs until October 26th.
Awesome.
And, oh, and actually, I mean, if it's okay to plug another stand-up
whatever
that I
you
love.
Want. Go ahead.
My husband, Dan Mintz, is releasing his first comedy album on October 7th. He's never done one.
Holy shit.
So...
He's never done one?
No.
How long has he been doing comedy?
A long time.
Forever.
He was like, trying to figure out what to call the album. He's like, should I call it This Took Me 10 Years? it took him a long time to get around to it.
That's crazy.
But it's exciting, so that's just a few weeks away. I
can't
believe it.
That's awesome.
So I definitely highly recommend that album.
Of course.
Is an album I've listened to many times.
Yeah, yeah.
While it was being put together.
That's
and that
so
sort
cool.
Of thing.
Oh but, my God! Do you know not to? Is he going to do a vinyl release of it at all? Is anybody going to put it out on vinyl?
I don't know. I mean, Comedy Central is releasing it,
oh, okay.
So they're kind of into that. I mean, I
yeah.
know it's there's going to be, like, a physical
sure.
CD in stores,
mm-hmm.
but I don't know. That's interesting.
I'm always curious. Sometimes people
Because sometimes they do.
Yeah.
I know Nick Thune did
yeah.
recently.
And, you know, Patton Oswalt's done. Like, sometimes they wait a while, you know, to
yeah.
release them.
Yeah, I'll ask him if he knows what's going on with that. And then if he is,
mm-hmm.
I will let you know. Because, yeah. Yeah.
So what date is that again? I'm sorry.
October 7th.
October 7th. Okay. That's
yeah.
awesome. What is
yeah.
it called?
The Stranger.
I like it. I like it.
Yeah.
That's so good. Oh, that's awesome.
Yeah.
Well, Margie, thanks for being here.
Thank you, Jason.
And
really.
You're always welcome back, of course.
Oh, thanks. This is very fun.
It was a lot of fun. Thank you guys for listening. And as always, have a good thing. Comedy on Vinyl is a production of Stolen Dress Entertainment. It is produced by Mike Warden and is hosted and edited by Jason Klom. Our theme song was composed and performed by Richard Levinson. Please visit stolendress.com to listen to our other podcasts, read our blogs, read our tweets, watch our videos, and read our books. Please subscribe on iTunes, and if you like us, give us a 5-star rating and a nice review. You can find us on facebook.com/comedyonvinyl, Twitter @comedyonvinyl, and find everything else at comedyonvinyl.com.